Well, I'm here.
Hi, Sandy.
How you doing? Hi, Janet.
Okay.
We gonna have a quorum?
I believe so. You have three excused absences today.
Hi, Amy.
Well, I guess I'm a little early.
It's always good to make sure everything's going all right. That's why I always check in early. I usually forget to turn on something.
Yeah. Sometimes my speaker doesn't seem to want to cooperate, and in which case I have to start waving my hands in order to respond.
Well, I got a new computer and my speaker wasn't working well. And so I was online with a computer expert for an hour and a half. And he finally said, is there a plastic strip covering up your microphone?
You got to be kidding me.
And that's what it was.
That's a terrible story.
A real high-tech problem.
Yeah. And it's $300 an hour.
No, this outfit is fabulous. It's called BoxAid. And
yeah,
he charged me for an hour, and which was $59.
And deep enough. Yeah.
Yeah. That group is just really outstanding. So
I have to share this with you. I had a flight to Orlando last year to go to a wedding, and it was canceled because of the virus. So instead we opted to take the money, the credit from United Airlines and go to Hawaii on the return. Which is, going to Hawaii right now is like going to a foreign country, by the way. I mean, you almost need a visa. But anyway, we went, and of course, we got on the plane. And I said, geez, I'd love to have a Bloody Mary. And when the stewardess came by, she said, no, we don't have any alcohol anymore, just beer and wine. What do you mean? This doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I've always had a drink. Well, you can't have it anymore. All right. On the return trip, it was an early morning flight, and I was prepared to spend $8 for a egg McMuffin because that was going to be breakfast. At row 20 out of 50, they run out of food. And of course, can you believe this?
Oh, man.
And so I ended up having pretzels and salted almonds for breakfast. That was it. Flying is not a lot of fun anymore.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Can everyone hear me? I didn't.
Yeah, sure. Hi.
Okay, good.
So do we have...
Are you in England?
No, that's Alan's always his backdrop.
Oh, I see. Stone.
I was going to change that to match my Hawaiian shirt, but I got on too late here.
You know, I rented a condo from a guy from La Silva Beach who owns La Silva Beach Spice Company. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
This guy, I guess he packages Himalayan salt and stuff like that. He's got a plant over there.
So do we have a quorum at this point?
No, we need eight.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
We need one. Six, we should have Bob Smith showing. We should have.
We have Bob Smith twice.
Yes, Bob, I'm trying to get it to work on on a tablet and it won't work. So I'm switching back to my phone, but it won't let go.
Six committee members so far.
Well, we need one more.
Eight. We have a new committee member joining us, so eight is the quorum now. New committee member. Seven. One more to join and we'll have quorum.
We're currently waiting for a quorum. We need one more person.
Don't we have eight? Look, I thought we had eight there.
We have seven, but we have a brand new committee member. So the quorum has increased to eight.
Oh, I was counting a staff person.
Oh, yes.
Bob Smith is still with us. I'm still counting eight.
Let's see. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. I have seven.
Okay.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. I'll check in on the attendees. Maybe someone came in the other way, another. Oh, yes, I see someone. I will promote them to panelists. We have quorum.
Okay. Very good. I will call the November 4th, 2021 meeting of the Monterey Bay Air Resources District Advisory Committee meeting to order. A roll call, please.
Right. Chair Brennan?
Here.
Committee member Copeland?
Here, it's Copeland.
Copeland, sorry. Committee member Critchley? Committee member Davis is excused. Committee member Gray?
Here.
Committee member Mack is excused absence. Committee member McClooney?
Present.
Thank you. Committee member Rack is excused absence. Committee member Smith?
Here.
Thank you. Committee member Storm?
Away.
Committee member Stroh?
Here.
Thank you. Committee member Swint? Absent. Committee member Turley? I see. Oh, there she is. I can't hear you, but I see you waving. And new committee members, Stasiak? Am I pronouncing it correctly, Julie?
Oh, it's Stasik.
Stasik. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, we do have quorum, Chair.
Thank you. Now's the time for comments from the public on items that are not on the agenda. Are there any public comments? Don't see any hands raised. Next item is changes to the agenda. Rich? You need to.
Yes. At this point, I think I'd like to pull item 7 until we have a full committee to go over the roles and responsibilities. We have 3 that called in at least this time. I could, if it's up to you, Chair, if you'd like me to just go over some of the roles and responsibilities and set it up for next meeting as well, we can do that too.
Okay, why don't we go ahead? We have a number of new committee members who are really interested in this item. So we can do it now and then summarize it the next meeting. Okay, now is the time to receive report on AB 361. Rich?
Yeah, so if we didn't have a quorum, we would not have been able to continue with this meeting. So it's a good thing we had folks call in. This, a little background on this new bill, which was signed into law recently, is that we were previously operating under the governor's executive order to allow us to relax the Brown Act requirements for teleconferencing. And those are essentially, if you were going to participate by phone or teleconference, you would actually, as a person, individual, have to notice that and let people into your home if you were going to have the conference at your home, for instance. Not too many people would do that. They'd go to a public place or meeting hall. But what, as a result of COVID-19, the governor signed an executive order allowing that to occur so that the requirements were relaxed. That law, executive order expired as the end of September, and AB 361 took effect. And in a nutshell, as a result of AB 361, it allows us to continue meeting through the teleconference or Zoom format. However, we have to make a couple of findings, and those are in your packet. But essentially, we need a state of emergency, which continues to exist in the state of California. And then we also have a recommendation by our health officer to social distance and to wear face masks while at public meetings. So our board of directors went through this exercise at our last meeting, and this is required every 30 days. So if we meet within 30 days, we wouldn't have to do this finding again. But at this point, what we need to do is have a motion from advisory council member to continue meeting through the teleconference system, Zoom, and then we have to all approve that as an advisory council. So I'll leave that up to folks. Are there any questions or comments or anything along those lines?
I have a comment. It's my understanding that in order to have a quorum, everybody, the quorum has to consist of people who are within the jurisdiction of the district itself, so that if somebody was in Hawaii, they could not constitute it being part of the quorum.
That's not my understanding.
Well, I'm on the Paro Sunny Mesa Community Service District, and I'm the president of that district, and that is the case. So we need to look at that before we make this decision regarding a quorum.
Do we have somebody in Hawaii?
For example, I mean, I was in Hawaii last week. So I could have been in Hawaii during the COVID regulations. I could be in Hawaii and still be a part of the quorum. That's not the case anymore.
Well, that's not my understanding issue right now. If it's an issue right now, then we'd have to defer to legal counsel. But my understanding that the teleconferencing and the rules have been relaxed by the governor's executive order and AB 361 allow for participation by teleconference. It makes no mention of actual physical location. So that to me does not really, I can't even see what the purpose of requiring somebody to be in the vicinity or in the district would really matter at this
point. Well, I'll get the regulation and sent over.
Well,
and I'll send it over to Siri. Yeah.
It shouldn't really
make any difference if everybody is here, but it does make a difference if in the future, if people are out of the area and expect to be a part of the quorum, to make sure we have a quorum, it won't work. So I'll get the information, I'll send it over, and if it's not applicable, then we'll just forget about it. But if it is applicable, we ought to be aware of it.
Sandy, I have a comment to you. The agenda that I have has the actual law. If you can find that section that refers to what you're talking about in there, that might be helpful.
I will. I'll send it over on Monday, tomorrow. I'll be at the district offices tomorrow, and I'll send it over to Siri. And then if it's not applicable, then it's not applicable. But I think if it is, we ought to be aware of it. That's all I'm saying.
I would like to note that I've had two or three presentations on this because I'm on various committees, and that has never been mentioned as a requirement of 361. So are there any other comments from committee members? Any comments from the public? Seeing none, back to the committee, motions in order.
Make a motion.
Move.
Thank you.
Is there a second to that motion?
I'll second.
Thank you.
It's been moved and seconded to adopt the findings as outlined in the report. Please take a roll call vote.
Will do. Member Stasek?
Sorry.
Yes or no to the motion, which is continuing the remote meetings?
Yes.
Thank you. Member Turley?
Yes.
I can hear you now. Thank you. Member Storm?
Yes.
Committee Member Smith?
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you. Committee Member McClooney.
Yeah.
Committee Member Swint, did you join us? Okay, just double checking. Committee Member Stroh?
Yes.
Committee Member Gray?
Yes.
Committee Member Brennan?
Yes.
Thank you. Committee Member Copeland?
Yes.
Committee Member Critchley? Do you join us? None. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. A pass with 9, and the others are absent.
Madam Chair, if I may indulge you, I just found a section in the law which states, for a legislative body holding a public meeting through teleconferencing pursuant to this section, all requirements in this article requiring the physical presence of members, the clerk, or other personnel of the legislative body or the public as a condition of participation in or quorum for a public meeting are hereby suspended.
Thank you. So the motion passes, and we will go on to the next agenda item, which is accept and file the summary of actions for the meeting of August 5th. Are there any comments or additions to the minutes from the public? Any comments or additions? If not, the actions are accepted and filed. So now on to the roles and responsibilities of the advisory committee. Rich?
Unmuting. Okay, so there's been a number of, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the advisory committee. There have been a number of questions and comments surrounding what the actual duties and responsibilities and roles and responsibilities of the advisory committee and its members are. And I thought it bears in mentioning again, I've spoken to the new folks that have onboarded so that you should have a pretty good understanding, but we have a very defined role here as an advisory committee, and that is to advise the board of directors. It's not a body which comes up with policies to implement or approves any kind of procedures, policies, or processes. It recommends adoption or approval to the board of directors. And we are not a research agency or an advocacy agency in terms of meeting specified interests of members or the public they may represent, unless it has to do with the functions of our agency. And for that, I just wanted the folks to know that the district is responsible for monitoring, air quality monitoring, permitting, enforcement, long-range air quality planning, regulatory development, rulemaking, education and public information activities related to air pollution as required by California and federal Clean Air Acts. We also are the primary enforcement mechanism for air pollution control, so we need our own rules and regulations to implement and enforce for the attainment and maintenance of federal and state ambient air quality standards. So in other words, we have a pretty defined role. Our budgets are based on this. So if somebody wants us to do something, for instance, we had a member that thought we weren't doing enough in climate change. And they wrote a letter to the board of directors expressing that opinion and actually came to the board and said that they thought we had to start regulating pollutants, CO2 specifically, in our jurisdiction to reduce the contribution of our industry to greenhouse gases. We also had another individual that felt that this agency could take on the California Air Resources Board with respect to regulating automobiles and specifically trucks. This individual owned a trucking company and he didn't think that the state was being fair to his industry. Those are not appropriate venues. Or this is not an appropriate venue for folks advocating on behalf of those policies. Although we do a lot with respect to climate change, we have very little regulatory enforcement authority for climate change. And we actually have been following other districts throughout the state that have taken on pieces of climate change rulemaking, only to be sued by the state Air Resources Board for violating what they feel is their turf. So the other thing is that you may have good ideas. We primarily regulate industry. We don't have a lot of authority to go into people's homes, although we do offer a wood stove changeout program. We don't have the authority to enter into a place, anybody's residence, and inspect their device to make sure they're operating correctly or burning correct fuel and that sort of thing. We can witness it from outside if the sun's up and we've got a good view of the smoke itself. And then we have to have a nuisance condition present for that. With respect to automobiles and trucks and that sort of thing, that is the primary responsibility of the California Air Resources Board. And they have had a waiver under the Clean Air Act that was taken away by the Trump administration, and that's seems to be back in there now. But we're cognizant that mobile source pollution contributes 70% or more of our overall pollution in the three county jurisdiction. However, we cannot regulate mobile sources. But what we do is have incentive programs to reduce emissions. And we're trying to switch fleets over to zero emission vehicles. For instance, we've done a lot with clean diesel and school buses, and now we're switching over to battery powered zero emission school buses, and transportation districts are also using some of our funds to purchase new zero emission electric buses, such as Monterey Salinas Transit. So there's been a lot of discussion that people would like to see presentations by other bodies relative to maybe air pollution or what other agencies are doing. I'm happy to accommodate that, but realize that many of the time we have very little input in the decision that other boards are or policy making that other boards are engaged in. I serve on the board of directors for the Transportation Agency of Monterey County and also on the Association of Monterey Bay Area Governments in an ex officio capacity, which means I don't vote on things, but we're very aware of what's going on as it relates to air pollution. And many times we're called upon to offer advice in that regard. The primary purpose of the advisory committee is to act as a surrogate to the public, which helps that we have a good cross-representation of folks within our jurisdiction that can comment on primarily rulemaking activities and some planning activities, which is the planning actions are sort of disappearing. I know Janet probably doesn't like to hear that, but we're seeing a lot of air districts throughout the state actually getting rid of their planning programs now and switching to grant programs. So in short, we have a pretty defined scope of what we're supposed to be doing. If you have suggestions on, for instance, agenda items or informational items you'd like to see, please feel free to discuss those with me. I'd be happy to put those on if it really applies to the work that we're doing here. But we'd love to be an educational source for committee members, and you're always welcome to contact staff and so forth to get additional information. But we can't go down the rabbit hole and start taking on additional duties and responsibilities associated with endeavors out of our scope and role of responsibilities. So I don't know, Janet, do you have anything you would like to add?
Do you have any I would kind of have a question. There's nothing precluding an advisory committee member appearing before the board on speaking on their own behalf on an item. Is that correct?
That's correct. And, you know, that's happened over the years. So that.
But if the advisory committee is going to speak to the board, it usually does it through the chair. So I just wanted to clarify that. Are there, I have no other comments. That was a good summary. Thank you, Rich. Are there questions from the committee? Karen Gray has her hand up.
Could you expand on what you meant that the air districts are moving away from planning to grants? What does that mean?
Yeah, as
Rich, could you restate the question? She was hard to hear.
I said that a number of air districts are moving away from planning activities to grant activities. And the reason being is a number of districts have come into attainment for their the state and national clean air standards. And as a result, they no longer have the planning requirements associated with non-attainment status, which means you have to show reasonable progress. If you're gonna take on additional measures or permit activities to reduce the pollutants that we regulate. And I should also say that the primary pollutants we regulate are the criteria pollutants, of which there are six. And those are things like SOx, the sulfur oxide, nitrogen oxide, particulate matter, ozone, lead, and carbon monoxide. Hopefully I got them all. And, primarily right now, we're only looking at particulate matter 2.5 and ozone as the primary pollutants we're monitoring, because those were the ones we were actually out of attainment with. We are still out of attainment with the state standard for PM10 in South County. We believe that's due to agricultural operations, and that's been discussed in the past, and we hope to make inroads in the future, but it seems like we're taking some steps backward. We do regulate toxics to agree to. So those are, whether they're federally listed, there's about 200 federal what's called hazardous air pollutants, and a subset of those is about 700 or 800 of the state-listed toxic air contaminants. So they're both the same thing, but one lives in a federal regulation and the other one lives in the state. One of the problems we've had, for instance, is regulating odor. That's a very difficult one. I get a lot of calls during the week about odors. We deal with coffee roasters and so forth, and it all boils down to land use. I don't want to get into an off-topic discussion here, but if somebody is granted the authority through the land use activity to situate a business that emits air pollutants or something that may even be odorous, we have limited authority at that point. We do something called require best available control technology. And that's happening with a lot of our coffee roasters, and we still see that there may be impacts. As I said before, we don't regulate residential sources of air pollution. We realize there are a lot of those, but we were sort of developed to regulate businesses that emit air pollutants, not vehicles and certainly not individuals. Although, you know, we'll take any gains we can where we can. As the agency head here and responsible to the board, I just have to make sure we have monies to pay for that. I know a lot of times it would be nice to have a van driving around looking for air pollution, but we have no way to pay for that unless there's some sort of enabling legislation or a tax imposed on the public or something like that. So those are just examples. I want to say this to quell any good ideas folks may have, and I encourage you to contact me. And you can also work with your board appointment, whoever appointed you. And that is also, or go through Janet, the chair, with items. But most agencies now, sorry to get back here, are don't have the planning requirements they once had. And now we're seeing a flood of money from incentives and grant programs, primarily from the cap and trade monies that the state is developing. So there's a lot of monies. South Coast, Bay Area, and San Joaquin are getting the lion's share of those monies, hundreds of millions of dollars. And some of the other air districts, us included, are seeing a significant increase. This year, our budget may spike to about $26 million. And our operating budget's seven of that. The rest is grant monies. So we're finding it increasingly more ominous and difficult. We're probably gonna have to hire additional staff to actually give more money away. So that's what I say. I know Yolo Solano County has done away with their planning division. They're now called their grants administration division, for instance. So that was long.
Not like too bad of a position to be in, Richard, but are you gonna have have you already allocated all that money coming in and earmarked it? I mean, can we know what that's going to?
No, that's a process. There are strings attached whenever the state gives us money. So there are strict requirements. We do cost effectiveness analyses. There are only qualified applicants. We hold workshops for those people. If we do change the program, however, this is the first stop along the way. We will get your input on how that program should look if we have some decisions to make regarding change up of the program or implementation of that program.
I'd like to make two comments. One, the district does review environmental documents, so that's part of what's traditionally viewed as the planning process. And secondly, I wrote an article. I've been involved with the Air District since 1984, either on the advisory committee or as a staff person for the district. And I recently wrote an article about the changing role of the district, which really more and more focuses in on the role of the Air Resources Board rather than the local level. Rich, you might consider sending that to board members because it does outline how things have changed over time. So are there other questions from committee members? Any questions from the public?
I had my hand raised.
Oh, Alan, I'm sorry.
I just had a quick question for Richard. How do you cycle your grant earmarking and dispersal? Is it on an annual calendar basis, or what is your cutoffs and your beginning times?
Well, you're asking the question that our auditor always asks, but we disperse on an annual basis, but the project life can be several years. So we have to make sure that we're holding a lot of money in reserves should those projects be completed ahead of time or on time. Oftentimes we get extensions to agreements or contracts we sign with the folks that are receiving the grant money. So it's a constant game of catch up to process the grants. And then we usually have folks usually pay we pay them as they go. So we just don't give $1 million to somebody and then say, go have fun. We'll have them request reimbursement under a schedule and then we'll withhold a certain amount of money towards the end of the contract to make sure we get all the contract completion elements as required. And then we'll pay out the final amount. So I think the exception is we are cutting checks to people that have purchased electric vehicles, for instance, or wood stoves. But typically they have to have bought and installed a wood stove before they'll get a reimbursement. So we really hold on to our money tightly here. And we have pretty strict guidelines with how we spend that money and who's qualified to apply for it. So, it's not just every year. So we have a lot of cycling through that money we called encumbered for a grant. So it goes in a pot, and this is what our auditor now is calling. I wish my administrative services manager here, but it's designated encumbrances or something along those lines so that we can show that those monies will get spent even though they're sitting in our bank account at the current moment.
Any other questions? I don't see any hands raised, so we'll go on to the next agenda item. Thank you, Rich. Go on to the next agenda item, which is receive a presentation on Rule 438. David Frisbee.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. After rules are in place and implemented over a period of years, we get the benefit of the experience of the enforcement staff, their experiences and their recommendations on improvements to those rules. And in this case, we're updating Rule 438, which is the open burning rules that covers all forms of burning in the region. We've looked at this rule and have revised it to improve readability, clarity, and enforceability. And so, it's in our constant effort of making improvements to our rules and our programs. So I'm gonna turn the presentation over to Chris Dumich, planner in planning division, and she will outline the revisions to the rule. And I want to just ask all of you if we really do want to hear your input and your guidance on the rule and how we can make it better if you have any concerns about it. So I'll turn it over to Chris.
Let me just share. Can you guys see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon. As David said, my name is Chris Dumich, and I'm one of the air quality planners here at the district. And we're going to talk about open outdoor fire rule, which is Rule 438. So some of this David has mentioned, but I'm just today in the presentation, I'm going to just go over a quick overview of Rule 438, talk about where it came from, inform the advisory committee of our proposed revisions, and discuss these revisions and mention any public comments we've received thus far. So Rule 438 was first adopted in April of 2003, and this is a list of the revision dates. You can see that we've revised it over time. Why we're updating it now is, as you can imagine, over time with enforcement out using the rule, they had some lessons learned and were able to identify some things that could be corrected. And in addition, we had a prohibition on driftwood that we wanted to add to the rule. So this seemed like a good time to put all these things in effect and update the rule. This slide shows you where some of the rules, the legislation came for us to develop this rule. It came from the California Health and Safety Code and the California Code of Regulations, Title 17. And as you can see, in section 3911, that talks about the definition of agricultural burning, some prohibitions. 4185 is important because that's the legislative intent, which tells not only the districts to create a rule, but for us to reasonably regulate, not prohibit. And then Title 17 just basically goes over the agricultural burning guidelines. I'll go over some of that in detail. So 41850 talks about agricultural burning, and I'm going to just pause for a second here. The way they talk about agricultural burning, it includes down here in the footnote 3911, agricultural burning in this rule talk, it means not only agricultural burning, but also forest management, range improvement, wildland vegetation management, which generally we talk about as being prescribed burning, which actually prescribed burning is a method in how to conduct those types of burns. Agricultural burning is very definitive as a burn on agricultural property. We also have a third type of burn permit called backyard burning. So that just to give you some clarification. So agricultural burning that is be reasonably regulated and not prohibited. And then it directs the state air districts to take this into consideration by adopting rules and regulations for the purpose of the article. And then 41852 basically just says a burn permit is required for burners. And as mentioned, this is just a little visual talking about the types of permits that we issue at the air district. These are not all the types of burn permits, but these are the ones that we issue at the air district and what's encompassed in Rule 438. And they include agricultural down in the bottom right, backyard burns is an example of a burn pile on residential property, backyard burns, as well as the wildland vegetation management, range improvement, et cetera, which would be conducted by prescribed fire. So the district objective, first and foremost, is to protect the public. And we do that by minimizing smoke impacts and also public nuisances, but we also don't want to exceed any air quality standards. So there's a lot of coordination of direct coordination efforts with burners, both federal, state, local, and also property owners, ranchers, even residences. So we do support the needs, the open burning needs of all these entities. And also education is a large component. And we educate in a couple different ways, not only by outreach, but we also have, you know, when someone gets a burn permit, part of the importance of that burn permit is that we include conditions, and that's to educate them on how to do burns safely and how to do them to minimize smoke impacts. Also, we field a vast amount of phone calls and emails from people that are interested in getting their permits. So they ask us questions like, what's the difference between a fire department and the air district? What's our role as the district in a burn permit? Where do they get their permits? Do they get them from the fire department or do they get them from us? And it depends on where they live. We help them figure that out. We also help them obtain a burn permit if they need assistance in doing so. We now have an online permit system. And so sometimes it's just recently been updated. So we do help them with that, navigate that. We talk to them about the burn seasons because different types of burn permits have different burn seasons. We also inform them of what a burn permit suspension and ban means in relation to the burn permit they may have or want. So today, the proposed revisions that we have made and we want to discuss with you, or that we're proposing rather, first and foremost, there was a general reorganization of certain texts. As the inspectors would go out and use the rule, they would notice that perhaps there was a prohibition embedded in definition that really needed to become its own prohibition so that it'd be not only easier for them to enforce, but also easier for anyone who reads the rule to understand and be able to follow, and just made things a little bit more clear. So we did some general reorganization of certain areas as needed. Also, we added the prohibition on driftwood burning. And then we added a few prohibitions that, as I mentioned, that were embedded in definitions already in the rule. We added a few definitions that we felt were necessary. And we also expanded upon some already existing definitions to make them a little more clear. First off, driftwood burning was entered in, is proposed as a prohibition because burning driftwood, any water-logged, saltwater-logged firewood that gets burned produces more dioxins than firewood. The important thing about dioxins is that the World Health Organization lists dioxins, or they categorize dioxins as part of a group called a dirty dozen, because they're a group of dangerous chemicals known as persistent organic pollutants. And the important thing to remember about that is they bioaccumulate over time, not only in the food chain, because you can get exposed to dioxins not just through smoke, but through what we consume and what we consume, whatever we consumed. But they're also highly toxic, and they're carcinogenic. They interfere with our hormones. They cause damage to our immune system. It causes developmental problems and reproductive problems. So it is a big deal. So we did introduce or are proposing a prohibition on burning driftwood. Some of the additional prohibitions we are proposing, the ones that were embedded in definitions, this is a list of them. I already mentioned the driftwood. We also put in, we're proposing a rule where there is an option for a permit that could be denied if somebody has had an issue in the past following rules or, you know, causing fires, burning outside of the rules or without a permit. The use of accelerants, we added that as a prohibition in backyard burning. Also public nuisance, smoke, they're not allowed to cause public nuisance, burning at tree stumps, et cetera. And as I mentioned, these were all kind of already included in some of our definitions. We just made them very clear as prohibitions. Oops. These are some of the new definitions. And although most of them are familiar terms, please keep in mind that some of the definitions are not necessarily Webster's dictionary version, such as disposal. We put a definition for disposal because it's the way we are explaining a certain definition. We use the term disposal, and we don't want people to misunderstand when we talk about disposal. We're not referring throw away. We're referring in that particular instance, disposal, because this is a burn rule, refers to disposing by fire, burning. Also, we added conservation burn kiln, which we wanted to add as a definition just to clarify it's different than a burn barrel. This shows you a list of pre-existing definitions that we just have expanded or renamed. And this lists all the details. We just added liquid petroleum, butane, diesel, et cetera, as part of the list of, under approved ignition device. We also renamed burn barrel to say burn barrel / container. Also down at the bottom, we established some limits for warming fire, not only temperature limits, but also a size of the warming fire, different in residential than in rural. And the woody waste from development definition, we changed to just be development burn. So at this point, we've only received one comment, and it was from a Rio Del Mar resident in Aptos. And in general, she was just very supportive of anything that would contribute to greenhouse gas emission reduction. She is not a fan of beach burning in general. She felt that it just caused unnecessary smoke impacts to the community, as well as the environment, air quality as a whole. In addition to some potentially, beach burns can potentially cause some, safety risks as far as like embers being burned or underneath sand and you can walk on it, and et cetera. So that was the sole comment that we've received at this point. And with that, that's the end of the presentation, but I'm here for any questions you might have.
Okay, Matthew has his hand up.
Yes, thank you for that great presentation. One thing caught my eye, and that was the driftwood definition. It specified the ocean, but didn't include any other overland conveyance, such as rivers or streams. And I was just wondering if that's intentional or if that should be included.
It wasn't intentional, but since it has to be the definition of driftwood or the way dioxins are emitted in this case is through salt water, and streams are generally fresh water, albeit in the Santa Cruz area, we do have several rivers that go out into the ocean, but they will go out and they will be waterlogged with fresh water and they have to deposit into the ocean and then wash ashore. I mean, obviously there's a possibility of freshwater only log, driftwood, floating up on like the San Lorenzo River and somebody carrying it and burning it elsewhere. But David is a Santa Cruz resident, so he would know more. I don't know if burning along the rivers are necessarily as common as definitely burning at the beaches, which is quite common because they do receive a lot of driftwood along some of the beaches in Santa Cruz County.
Okay, Karen,
Gray. Yes, Chris, thanks for the presentation. One thing, maybe I missed it, but what might be good to have in the rule is if you're going to burn, you're responsible to notify your neighbors, your community. I know we have quite a few sufferers in this community, like asthma, respiratory disease, other infirmities, particularly soon. And wouldn't it be prudent if you're going to burn that you are responsible for notifying those neighbors, those people in the community at some distance from the burn site about the event?
Well, in relation to obviously prescribed fire, agricultural burning, and backyard burning, I don't believe it's a requirement. They are required. We do advise them to notify their local fire entity, because what usually happens is if someone sees smoke and they call someone, they're going to call the fire department. And so that way the fire department knows exactly who's burning. They can notify the neighbor. It would be a good idea as a good neighbor to notify your neighbors. And I do know some areas like up in Santa Cruz Mountains where they do a lot of backyard burning. That is commonplace. They do notify their neighbors. They have Facebook groups for their community and they post just to let everybody know. But it's I don't believe it's a requirement that they have to notify people.
Alan Stroh.
I had to unmute. Anyway, I noticed that you referred to seasonal burns. I'm just kind of wondering, given the climate change, is that a relevant term these days in vis-a-vis, burns? Because the weather has been so unpredictable. We have summer and winter and summer, and, is that a definition that's viable in terms of a policy or rule, excuse me? I'm just wondering if it should be defined differently as, predictive weather patterns at the time of the issuance of the permit, because how do you really use seasons to really predict what the what the weather's going to be to allow the smoke to rise straight up?
Are you talking about the term burn season in itself?
Well, I'm just bringing out the fact that when you use the term season, it implies like, this season is better than other seasons to burn. But that I'm wondering if that even means anything anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm just asking your opinion about that.
Gotcha. Well, definitely, I think in this case, the term season implies to when burning is allowed. For example, backyard burn season, backyard burning is only allowed December 1st through April 30th, and that's by law. So that is the burn season for backyard burning, whereas something like agricultural burning or prescribed burning is technically allowed year round pending any bans or permit suspensions by CAL FIRE. But you're right, things are changing. We've all seen it. David and I have had many discussions on this. And, you know, it used to be wildfire season used to be in the hottest months of the year. It was in the summertime into early fall, but it usually ended. But we find that now it's extending. It used to be about, you know, 4 to 6 months. Now we're seeing it go 9 months, and eventually it will probably be almost year round. But that's why, and we do check meteorology for the larger burns, such as prescribed fire. We coordinate closely with the burners. We do advise them on days that it would be best to burn. Even if it's a burn day, it might not be the best day for smoke management and smoke impacts. So we do coordinate with the burners for prescribed fires because those are generally larger. But usually in backyard burns, the season December 1st or April 30th is because the wintertime generally is more disturbance, which, you know, bodes well for smoke management, and there's less impacts. When it's the high pressure season, the warmer weather, it's when we get the, you know, the smoke will tend to stay close to the ground, the airspace, and cause more smoke impacts. So it's really more of a burn season, but meteorology definitely plays a huge role in smoke impacts, and we do monitor it. But primarily, if it's backyard burn season, that time was selected because inherently it's mostly burn days those days, whereas winter or summertime, it's definitely more risky. But it is wildfire season, and we often have CAL FIRE that submits either a burn permit suspension or a ban, so generally no one's burning during those months anyway.
Well, I'm not muted again. I just brought up the point. It's really kind of a picky point, but I was just saying, as long as you're revising rules, do you want to use terms that are a little more precise? I realize that there's a law that defines burn seasons and all of that, but nevertheless, as reflected in the rules, should that reflect? Does it need to do that, or is it time to rethink terminology? I'm just looking at terminology that may be somewhat misleading at this point in time. That's all.
That's a good comment.
That's it.
Okay. We'll talk about it.
You're muted, Chair Brennan. You're muted.
I'm sorry. Karen Gray has her hand up.
Sorry, I just wanted to reiterate, Chris, that I really think in the rule, there should be something about having to notify surrounding people. I mean, statistically, we have something like 60,000 people suffering from asthma in the mm-hmm. Center District. Mm-hmm. They need the opportunity to know to either move out of the area or close up their windows before a burn event. We have people with COPD, other cardiac infirmities that are susceptible to smoke. And this is what's causing the problem. You know, you got to get people an opportunity to either close up their house or go out or move away for the day so they're not suffering health-wise. From smoke.
Okay, thank you.
Other comments from committee members? This is a presentation for comments only. Are there comments from the public? Okay, if not, we will go on to the oral report from Rich. We were sent his report, which is 3 pages long. So Rich, if you want to summarize key points.
Lost my cursor. All right. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll blast through this as quickly as possible. At the top, you'll see what the Board of Directors has been up to for the past 3 meetings. We did meet in August, but the board met later on in the month. So you'll see just in general that we're going over a lot of informational items to the And then, of course, they also had to do the AB 361 authorization at our last meeting, and that will continue, and it actually covers the 30-day period, will encompass our next meeting. So if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. But you're also seeing that we're getting a lot more monies for grant monies from the state. They're carving up more monies for air districts to do grant programs. We're also doing a bunch of recruitments for the district. It seems like since I've been here, I've never seen so much turnover with respect to people moving on or are retiring. So we're currently looking for an air quality engineer. We have final interviews scheduled for tomorrow. And we've got the air quality monitoring specialist and air quality planners open for the immediate future. So we know we have one retirement and another planner is going to be leaving the agency to move on to another air district. So a lot's going on in the recruitment venue. And then I'll just say we've got a new database system, which Amy Climo has been along with the staff implementing, and it's actually proven to be pretty successful, especially as compared to how things were in the past. And we're going to have more online presence for applications and for the public to look into some of our information. I should also, under planning and air monitoring, let folks know that our e-bike incentive program is up and running. That's a program that came out of the board of directors, specifically Wendy Root Askew made the suggestion that we include that as an electric vehicle. We've had a lot of interest and we've been getting a lot of love from bicycle manufacturers and dealers and distributors. This first out of the gate program, we sort of were putting it together as we were flying the airplane. But think we've got a good program right now that we'll definitely try to change and we'll be bringing back to you again. But right now it's just open to low-income qualified applicants. And we're using Central Coast Energy Services to make that determination. So once they get those approvals, then they're eligible to apply. And I don't know, David, if we've had two applications thus far, has that increased? No. So, you know, we only have $50,000 available and the award is up to $1,000. So it's a pretty good deal for some folks. I know the first couple of bikes were in the $1,200 range. So they're getting an e-bike for $200. We're also sort of not progressing as quickly as we'd like on the EV incentive program. So I would reach out to any of you. If you're thinking about getting an electric vehicle, now's the time. We have pretty good incentives and you can stack that along with the community energy and the state's offering a $7,500 or the feds are offering $7,500 tax incentive. And I think it's $2,000 with the California vehicle rebate program. So it's sort of the perfect storm for incentives. And I think PG&E as well as community energy may be helping out with batteries at your home as well. So good time to be electric vehicle or leasing one. Other than that, I think that we're still working on air monitoring sensor network. This is something that's actually pretty new to this agency and a little bit outside of our normal wheelhouse, but it's we're putting together a network of sensors. They're not regulatory monitors, but air quality sensors throughout our jurisdiction to look into the season of wood fires or wood smoke from wildfires. And that's pretty much all year now. So we've got to actually, if you go to our webpage, we've got a separate page that has information on that program as well as a map showing where these sensors are deployed. And I think that's pretty much it. We're starting our wood smoke season up in the San Lorenzo Valley where people are still relying on wood heating devices to heat their homes. We hope to maybe partner with the Central Coast Community Energy to get folks off of wood and into some of these more efficient heat pump devices. And so, but we continue to offer wood stove changeouts, and we understand that the governor has included $5 million in next year's budget for air districts to operate incentive programs. We don't have any money from the state this year, so we have a paltry, I think $80,000 we're gonna be distributing this year. So that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions from the committee? Any questions from the public? If not, thank you very much, Rich.
But Janet, if I may, I'd just like to add that that there had been a request from AMBAG to make a presentation on their sustainable community strategy.
Yes.
And I talked to their director, and they said they are tied up with the regional housing allocation right now. They're trying to prepare a bunch of reports. They won't have anybody available to talk to this committee until we meet again in February.
Okay,
I had my hand up there. I had a question. You mentioned e-bikes and being aimed at low income only at this point in time. One of the, I've researched it pretty good for myself because I just bought a couple of e-bikes, but I think you still have a rule that it has to be bought at, from a local distributor within Monterey County. I'm just wondering how viable that is if you're really aiming for low-income folks, because I got bikes from a couple of bikes from Arizona from a company called Electric Bikes, and I think they advertise quite a bit, but I got two really great electric bikes for the price I would have paid locally, almost for the price I would have paid locally for one. And, you know, I'm wondering if you wanted to, at least for low-income folks, if you wanted to expand that the program just a little bit to allow them to buy out of areas so they can get one, so they can really apply the the grant, and I think it would be a marvelous incentive because you can get those bikes, really nice bikes, at a really good price if you can buy out of area. It's a question of what's your goal, to incentivize local retailers or to incentivize people to get electric bikes, you know?
So the board weighed in pretty heavily on this. They feel that the local element is essential to this program. So they did not want to see. And we also, after much discussion, this was not an easy decision. This is our first year too, so this could change, but there was a lot of discussion about being able to buy things on Amazon really cheap, have it delivered to your front door. The problem with that, it's like a regular bicycle that if you do not buy from a certified or a legitimate bicycle shop, usually they have somebody in-house that's assembling them en masse. The bikes may not be assembled correctly. And then if you need to get it serviced, if you bought it online, you're sort of out of luck in that regard. And we thought that just like for bicycle stores, and they're pretty adamant about this, the local bike shops, is that a bike should be put together by the bike store where it's done its work. And then also, it also gives periodic checkups to make sure the bike's functioning. Because the last thing we want to do is buy a bike, have somebody put it together incorrectly and have it invalidate the warranty or not be able to get it serviced. And there's a lot of stories. We workshopped this whole issue with a number of the bicycle and pedestrian committees for the transportation agencies. And this is what we arrived at. Plus we're working with the local bike shops. There are a number of them that offer electric bikes to the community, and they're more than willing to tackle this and help out in this regard. So in the future, that may be the case. I don't think we'd, you can go to Costco and get a bike in a box for $300. And we wanted to avoid that type of bike because they're small wheels, they're not really reliable. And we just don't want to be paying to have things, stuffed in somebody's garage.
Well, from personal experience, I think those are arguments that could be made, but I think they're very specious arguments because the bike I got was pretty much all assembled. There was very little I had to do when it came out of the box. And all I had to do was basically charge up the battery. So, and they recommended that I take it to a local bike shop just to have them look at everything. And that would, that I'm going to do that. And that's very minimal cost to do that.
Well, you may be surprised because a number of bike shops will may not want to work on your bike because they may feel that it's, I'm just saying, this is the comments we've received. You're also talking to somebody that's got a lot of experience in the bike industry. So a lot of bicycle shops will not work on some bikes that have been purchased and put together by the consumer, or if they have, if they're of sort of dubious origins.
Okay, I'm just saying you got two economic arguments going here. One is to get electric bikes out to people that need them to get to their jobs, which I am assume is the purpose of keeping them to low-income groups of people. And the other economic argument is the good of the bike shops, which I think the focus needs to be clarified. You know, that I just my opinion, but.
Well, let it be clarified. It is for the good of the bike shop.
Yeah.
Okay. Karen Gray has her hand up.
Yeah, I can attest to that. I mean, I bought an e-bike online, and I had a very difficult time finding any shop that would touch it in Monterey. So you got to be mechanical when you're doing that. Richard, I want to get back to the EV things. I was curious how the event in Salinas went. And also, I wanted to get my personal experience, which is I ordered a electric vehicle from a dealer in Seaside, and I'm lucky if I'm getting it in February. So it's definitely slow right now.
Yep. So the first question, the event went really well. We teamed up with Ecology Action. We helped sponsor the event. We had Siri was there along with a couple of our other staff all day. And it was a fun time for everybody, lots of educational activities and lots of static displays and so forth. And we were getting calls because I guess the event was booked up like a day before for all the rides. So you couldn't show up and get into a car apparently if you had not made a reservation. So that shows you how successful it was. So we hope to do more of those, but you're right. I think for any vehicle right now, you've probably heard on the news that even gas-powered cars, there's a chip shortage, and a lot of the manufacturers are not being able to meet orders, and prices are going up on all vehicles. I heard that Tesla just raised the price on their Model 3 by $2,000 or $3,000. So, you know, that sort of wipes out some of the incentive monies there, but still, we see a lot of new vehicles coming out. The Ford F-150 is taking deposits right now, but I'm told that it'll probably be 2 years before you can get one. And I personally would like to see the VW bus. I'm very interested in that. That's probably not going to be out for a couple of years as well. So it's a tough time. And I think cars are in general used cars. New cars are, it's sort of a seller's market. But having said that, we also want to encourage people to get some of the used vehicles that may be out there. And for instance, a Nissan Leaf can be had or used to be able to be had as of maybe 3 or 4 months ago, relatively inexpensively, I mean, $8,000. So we would encourage people that don't have this really, really high mileage needs to go with a used vehicle and so forth. So that's one of the markets that's sort of untapped by the state program, and the federal program does not give any incentives, but we do, and so does Community Power.
Thank you. Caitlin Turley?
Alan had his hand up before me though, but if you don't mind, do you wanna go?
Okay.
Go ahead, Caitlin.
Oh, okay.
Alan? Oh, Alan?
Okay, all right, well, just a brief comment, update. I ordered a Tesla Model Y in August, late August, and they told me I wouldn't get it till January, February. However, I went over to the Tesla dealership this week and they told me that they were gonna notify me the next day that my my Model Y was there on the lot in Seaside and ready for delivery. So they're cranking them out. And what I did, I delayed up to 90 days because I found out also the next day when I called Tesla at their main headquarters over in East Bay, that they were now delivering the new Tesla Model Y with the new battery packs, which are going to go from 324 miles if you get the good one, and up to 400 and possibly something miles. So they're delivering those starting yesterday. And I just thought let you guys know if any of you are interested in Teslas, but they seem to have, I guess they're not having the same kind of supply problems some of the other auto manufacturers are having.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no other questions, we'll go on to the next.
Caitlin.
Oh, I'm sorry, Caitlin.
No worries. So two quick questions. How has COVID impacted the new recruitment process? And then the second question is about the e-bikes. If I go to the website, I don't see much about safety. Do we have, or the board, anything with the program have anything to do with encouraging or informing people of e-bike safety? So, or is it more of a hands-off thing? If you've ridden a bike, you'll be okay on an e-bike.
Well, that's probably gets to one of the, thank you for that question. That probably gets to the issue that Alan brought up. But if you buy a bike from a bicycle store and you have questions or concerns, typically, they'll take you around and show you the ropes with respect to bicycle, how to operate it, and the safety features in that bike. The other issue with that, too, is the larger wheeled bicycles that are more expensive typically are inherently more safe than some smaller ones that can disappear in potholes, for instance. So, but we did have some questions. I think we were going to put a safety video on our website, too, about electric bikes, and I'll check with our electric bike guy on that, but we wanted to. We were approached by Ecology Action, who in the past has done some safety training for people that have received bikes. We felt like we would rather get the money out there invested in the bike itself. But if we can rely on other media such as videos, and there's a lot, by the way, on YouTube on how to safely ride a bicycle, especially an e-bike. A lot of the communities concern, especially people on non-battery powered bicycles, they're concerned about e-bikes taking over and going at exorbitant speeds on the bike paths. So it's sort of a two-way street. And I think this issue is going to come to a head in the not too distant future, depending on how successful we are at getting more bikes out there. I'm sorry, and then your next question.
How has the new recruitment process been going with COVID?
Well, we just started it, so I'll just say this, that we've had an interest from a number of people that want to know what our policies are with respect to working from home. And that's also diverges a little bit outside of our model. Typically, we rely heavily on training people in person for their probationary period. So we're still requiring people to show up. I'm not sure what kind of impact that will have, but we've actually had to start over recruitment. We actually went through recruitment for a senior air monitoring technician. And because of retirement considerations, the individual backed out and we had another person. It's actually a soap opera, but we had another person we did a background check on and found out that they weren't really telling us the exact honest truth about things. So suffice to say, we've had to go back and re-recruit for that monitoring position. But staff has been sort of pulling together and picking up the pieces, especially David. If you have any sympathy, look at him today because his section is dwindling and he's getting more money to do more things. So I will say this, for our planner, we've so far received, I think it's up to 7 applications. And we hope to, we extended it one more week. So we hope to see more people. So that's all I can tell you at this point, but it probably has an impact, but it doesn't seem to be a daunting impact at this point.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay. I do not see any other hands up. Next item, our future agenda items. I have a suggestion. Monterey, the county, and Carmel are all doing climate action plans. It might presentation by one or all would, I think, be of interest. Any other suggested agenda items? Okay, seeing no hands up. I have no comments. Comments from committee members? Karen?
I know that MBART and Sirius particularly is starting up the Twitter and Instagram campaigns for that. And I was wondering if it'd be a future item we could all maybe help by pitching in some ideas and thoughts about social media campaign ideas.
Okay. So that's a future recommendation for an agenda item. Thank you. Any other comments? All right. If there's no other business, we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you for attending.
Thank you.